are, some ways we always say, connected to the first Mishnah. Let's say. We're going to get to the second Mishnah, God willing, by the end of the evening in the Perek, or the next Mishnah. Depending on how manuscripts were divided up, you could have had some of this material about who did not receive a share in the world to come in a little separate of a, what was like a Brita or Mishnaic section. Anyway, the end of the first Mishnah, after we say everybody has a share in the world to come, to remind ourselves where we sit in terms of context, is that individuals then were named as not having a share in the world to come. They were certain kings, and certain individuals were called out for not inheriting the world to come. And so, the Gemara goes in towards the next several pages after our whole Messiah discussions, back to the issue of these kings, and back to the issue of thinking about the kings as representatives of the Jewish people in the great chapter of history, the taking of Jerusalem and being situated in Jerusalem, holy capital of the kingdom of David, as part of an overall picture of the annals of history as realities that come about because of either our righteous behavior, our sinful behavior. It's all linked to the individuals themselves in terms of their ethical behavior as leaders of the Jewish people. It's that context of the chapters of history and ethical behavior that I want to look into the materials stemming from pages 104 all the way through, 103 really, that you have in front of you in the packet, where I have 103A as the first page in the packet, 103A3. And I just want to pick out a few spots that in some ways will give us some insights into the Gemara's outlook, this chapter's outlook on what does it mean to be a people who are caught in the great narratives and dramas of history, people who are striving for an ethical life and for some sense of redemption, either in this world or the next one. Okay? So that's the context here. And I want to start on this right left side of the page on 103A3, where you see it says, in connection with its discussion of the wicked kings of Judah, the Gemara now presents an exegesis of Proverbs 24:30-31, the first of three interpretations of scriptural passages by Rav Pista in the name of Rabbi Yirmiah bar Abba. Okay? A mnemonic. By the field of houses there shall not befall. Siman al sadeh batim lo te'uneh. Amar Rav Chista amar Rabbi Yirmiah bar Abba. Rav Chista said in the name of Rabbi Yirmiah bar Abba, Maik dichtiv al sadeh ish atzel avarti. What is the meaning of that which was written? I passed by the field of a lazy man. Va'al kerem adam chasar lev. By the vineyard of a man who lacks sense. V'hine Allah chulo kim shonim. It was all overgrown with thorns. Kasufanav charulim. Its face was covered with nettles. The geder avanav neherasa, and its stone fence lay in ruins. Al sadeish hatzel avarti, taking apart the verse in small ways. Ze achaz, this is achaz. Va'al kerem adam chazar lev, ze menashe, by the vineyard of a man who lacks sense, this refers to menashe. These are the people who are named out for not having a share in the world to come. This refers to Amon, the wicked son and successor of Manasseh. Kasufanav Harulim, Ze Yehoyakim. Its face is covered with nettles. This refers to Hoyakim. Vegedrav and Avnerasa Ze Tzidkiyah. And its stone fence lay in ruins. This refers to Tzidkiyah. So, one interpretation is that you can find the annals of history within the either kind of like a mnemonic device, or the sections of a verse that seem to not be referring exactly to the players in history. It's coming from Proverbs. So I make mention of this part of the Gemara for this reason. Because later I'm going to read you some commentary by the great Philo of Alexandria. And even though this isn't particularly an allegory per se, he also thought that you could find within wisdom literature references to individuals, that there were really these hidden stories of individuals within the small stories or narratives built within the text of the Tanakh. Now, I give you that sense because there is a certain degree of acceptance of finding references to the tales of history and to value orientations within wisdom literature and within the verses of Tanakh that I wouldn't say is pervasive, but for sure exists in the ancient world. And this seems to be one of those places where Rav Chisda finds within the Bible and Mishnah and wisdom literature the validation of what the Mishnah is saying ultimately at the end of our Mishnah, that is, individuals who have no stake in the world to come are referred to in ways that we can perhaps understand, that the verse from Proverbs explaining to us why they ultimately received such a judgment in the world. Or at least that they are described as such, as people not receiving, as not being worthy of the world to come. Second of three interpretations. Look at the right side. V'amar Rav Chisda amar Rabbi Yirmiyah bar Abba. Rav Chisda says in the name of Rabbi Yirmiyah bar Abba, Arba kitzot ein mekabalot p'nei shechina. In a more general sense now, I bring it out, I increase the purview of what I'm able to now teach once I've talked about, again, the individuals who don't really have ethical ways about them, who are somewhat known as sinners now, in that they don't receive the world to come. And I'm going to make some general categories. I'm going to work out general categories of behavior here because I want to, if I'm this author, I'm the editor of the Gemara, I want to include in this tractate, it's been my claim since the first class we've had about it, that I want to give people a sense of what it means to live an ethical life, and I want to define Jewish value concepts, a la what I called Max Kedushin style, what he wrote as value concepts, rabbinic value concepts. And they can be said in the negative, and they can be said in the positive. You shall have chesed, and do chesed, kindness, you shall be so, and you shall not be like this and like that. So Rav Chisda's teaching in the name of Rabbi Yirmiyah bar Abba says, there are four classes who don't receive p'nei shechina. Now the reference to shechina too interests me, because where does shechina supposedly dwell? In galut with those who are exiled. It's not just Jerusalem. We have a midrashic tradition that the Shekhinah is exiled with us. The indwelling presence of God is indeed among us. And we can find then some holiness, and real in being, you know, being in touch with holiness is part of our narrative, even in the exile.
What rings in my ears is Kabbalat Shabbat and the phrase Lekabel, Kabbalat Pnei Shechinah. So it could refer to the actual experience, the personal experience of the Kabbalat Shechinah on Shabbat.
Nice. For sure, there was some level of accepting of Shabbat ethos in that time. The poetry, of course, of Lechadodi and this kind of Kabbalat Shabbat, Shabbat in that way is much later in our history, and probably they're riffing off such a Kabbalah from the times of the Gemara into the production of the poetry of the 16th century.
The presence of the Shekhinah was is an ancient one.
I mean, you can say that there
not
was...
Not because of the song, but just because...
Yeah. I mean, you could say that in Masechet Shabbat there is this sense that we have to lekabel p'nei Shekhinah and that Shabbat has to...
So is a daily, is an immediate personal experience. That's what I mean by that.
Right, but linguistically, if you're talking mekablot pnei shechina as being connected with l'chadodi, it's an interesting connection.
Yeah.
All right, so for classes of sinners, four classes of sinners don't receive the divine presence. Kat leitzim, the class of scoffers. Kat shakranim, the class of liars. Kat chanefim, the class of flatterers. And kat misapre lashon hara, and the class of those who speak lashon hara. So here are four things that really you want to avoid if you want to be among those who receive the Shekhinah, and you want to be among those who ultimately receive the whole notion of your place in Olam Haba, whatever that really means. Let's talk about each one. The class of scoffers. What's a scoffer? Well, Leitzim is a term that appears throughout Tanakh literature, for sure. And it also appears in the Mishnah. One of the Mishnayot that we're looking at this week, if you study Pirkei Avot, says that you could really be a fool, and if you're a fool, it's kind of the opposite of your being wise. And the notion of sitting with these scoffers comes out in Psalms, and that we ultimately see them as mocking God in a way and mocking wisdom. The class of scoffers, how do we prove that from a verse? Because our project is to prove things from a verse and to bring verses that prove our positions. He withdrew his hand from scoffers. Kat shakranim dichtiv dover shkarim lo yikon l'neged einav. The class of liars, as it is written, one who tells lies shall not be established before my eyes. Kat chanefin dichtiv ki lo lefanav chanef yavo. The class of flatterers, as it's written, for before him no flatterer shall come. Kat mesaper l'lashon hara dichtiv ki lo el chafet rasha ata lo yigor chara. The class of those who speak Lashon Hara, it's written, for you are not a God who desires wickedness. Evil cannot abide with you. Sadikata v'loyihiye bimgur chara, which means you, God, are righteous. Therefore, an evil one who speaks evil, shall not be allowed in your abode. So, these four types of approaches really are on the heels of proving that the individuals named in the Mishnah don't deserve their place. And should you engage in these types of behaviors, neither should you. Or at least this is what you'll have to make tshuva for. Because we've seen in the other parts of what we've read already that not everybody can be perfect. And tshuva is, of course, possible. And you should definitely steer clear of each of these kinds of habits or these kinds of sins.
Let me go back to the previous brisa. The last king, Tzidkiyahu, was not a Rasha. A Rashi, I see, says that he was a righteous man, and the only reason he's included in this exegesis is because the temple was destroyed during his reign. And I think Tzidkiyahu is mentioned in the Mishnah as one of the people who doesn't have a portion in the world to come.
Yeah, the reason why we call Tzidkiyahu, I understand, and Rashi brings this after that,
Rashi says,
is that Call a door sheld Tzidkiyahu hayu
rishayim. But he really wasn't an evil man.
He didn't. So there's an interesting piece there, like in one of, I can't remember exactly who said it, but Tzidkiyahu, who was this kind of puppet leader, right, of the Babylonians, So it says in the Rashi that everybody in that generation was evil, and then somebody said he had absolutely no power to make anyone do tshuva. And that was really his fault.
I think the reason why they say it's him is because the words are v'geder avanav nerasa. So I guess they're saying that the temple was a fence of stone, and that's why they attribute this to Zedekiah.
Nice. Nice connection. Okay. Let's read the last one, the last of three interpretations. Now, it's possible that, again, they're trying to moralize. They're also dealing with the notion of kind of accepted and received concepts at this point. I think they're trying to bring together a certain group of concepts that make, again, for a vocabulary of the righteous life. Eugene Borowitz wrote a book called The Moral Virtues. He's translating from some Musar literature. He also talks about like the Jewish vocabulary of morality and an entire collection of those languages of morality coming through, and the notion that we try to support one another in our endeavors to achieve righteousness before the Lord. So it could just be as simple as we have another teaching in the name of Rav Chisda, though. So this could be a small chapbook of Rav Chisda's moral teachings and a collection of vocabulary about morality, or it could very well be that this was the third teaching we had in the name of Rav Chisda, and it seems to relate somehow to the other two, or that this really did come in threes because the person memorizing Rav Chisda's teachings was very good at memorizing Rav Chisda's teachings, and this was the third one that he would give over if you want to know about what Rav Chisda taught. So let's look at it. Va'amar Rav Chisda amar Rabbi Yirmiyah bar Abba, and Rav Chisda said in the name of Rabbi Yirmiyah bar Abba, Mai dichtiv lo ti'une alecha ra'av and nega lo yikrav bo alecha. What's the meaning of that which is written? No evil will befall you, nor will any plague come near your tent. So the obvious split of the verse, no evil will befall you, and then we'll deal with, nor will any plague come to your tent. So no evil will befall you. Lo tunei lecha ra, shelo yishlot bahen yetzer hara. That the evil inclination should not rule over you. V'nega lo yikrav bo alecha. Nor will any plague come near your tent. Ishtecha safek nida, b'sha'a shetavo min haderech. This means, may when you return from a journey to your home, let there be no doubtful state of nida. In other words, what's the hope? That you'll return home, and that you'll have relations. The Chachamim, in this sense, what are they doing? If this is some type of moral code that's being formed, why have a teaching about such a hope? So this is an interesting piece that I once got to talk about with Daniel Boyarin. We've mentioned him before in our Beit Midrash. Daniel Boyarin wrote a great book about relationships and body and embodiment and the power of carnality within and among the rabbis and in Israel, if you will. So the book is called Carnal Israel. He says that having a righteous relationship with your wife and bodily pleasure in this sense is as powerful as what? What was the other teaching above? Accepting the face of the Shekhinah. Now, this is a mystical trope, potentially, that such relations are not exactly likened to the kind of mystical union that has become associated with the sex act, Kabbalat Shabbat, or otherwise, between man and woman in later mystical texts, but that there is a certain foundational reality of godliness within that relationship, which is done in the right moment where a woman is not in nida or in spek nida, where she's not in any which way wondering whether or not there's a certain level of need to attend to her period of lack of readiness and then need to go to the mikveh in order to be acceptable for relations with her husband. And this, as a piece of the moral code, what's that?
It sounds a little selfish to me that this is, you should come home and your wife is ready for you. This is, I mean.
Oh, but the wife is the one who can demand it. By the way, in the second ketubah, you know.
You know, she's like a plague coming to your house.
You could read it that way, Bobby. I hear you. You could definitely read, you know, with that, let's say, with that grain.
Yeah. All right, but in the priorities here, in terms of talking about really big, important things about evil and good, I don't think that this is, you know, this seems a little self-centered to me.
You know, we read this book in depth, and we studied it in depth, and we studied like the whole notion of what are the rabbis trying to do in building a sanctified relationship between man and wife, and what are they trying to do with addressing sex and sexuality and relations and purity of relations within the Gemara, and that is maybe, according to, you know, a quippy remark in the Beit Midrash, maybe more goodness would come if more people found the time and really did enjoy such pure relations.
But the context is the mitzvah of having children. It's not necessarily focused on pleasure. It's the commandment.
Well, that's where Boyarin will say that it's not all the time.
I didn't say all the time.
Not here. And also, your language itself is really where I think Bobby and I both get sort of, because I get that reaction, man and wife. You have not yet once ever said husband and wife. And that is a profound explanation of the concept of Beit Hadin. There's no equality of the partnership when you say man and wife.
Okay, so the partners.
The text said it, but the rabbi doesn't have to keep repeating it when he's talking.
Okay, so it's about the partners finding one another.
Right, that's fine.
And so if that's the case, that's all fine and well. But maybe some people were as unsure about that interpretation, so there's a Devar Acher. And simply put, Devar Acher is an interesting conceptual piece in the Gemara itself. How often do we get simply Devar Acher? People who study Rashi see that he's included that term often when he finds one midrash that contextualizes a passage in the Torah within the context of the greater rabbinic narrative that he wants to build, that he calls the Peshat. But he'll oftentimes also bring you a different midrashic teaching in order to, you know, quote-unquote, enlighten the eyes. Right? So here, what's the other possibility? Lo tunei lecha ra'a shelo yivatucha chalomot ra'im v'hirhurim ra'im. No evil will befall you. This means may no bad dreams or bad thoughts terrify you. V'nega lo yikrav v'olecha shelo yehelecha ben o talmid shemakdiach tavshilo v'ravim. Nor will any plague come into your tent. This means may you not have a son or a student who burns his dish in public. So what is burning the dish in this point?
Goes off the path.
Goes off the path. That somebody should be true to Torah, that somebody should be true to the teachings of the sages, that somebody should not embarrass, potentially, it could be also that somebody doesn't embarrass his family.
Yeah, the public is the key.
Right. And in the context of kings who had children who themselves do not inherit the world to come, I think this is the reason why you have this alternative explanation, and they move it away from the moralist teaching and the let's set up the family right teaching, and they bring it right back to the kingdom of David and the kingdom of Solomon, and that Ad Kan Bercho Aviv, up to this point Solomon's father blessed him. Who's Solomon's father? King David. Who they have a lot to say about over the course of the passages, we won't read those particularly, but just to give you the insight in basic ways, King David is here held up as someone who obviously inherited the world to come, but whose path to forgiveness was made very obvious because he's known as someone who had to make tshuva, right? So, Mikan ve'elach berachto imo, from this point on, his mother blessed him, though. So here's a positive voice of the father and the mother blessing the son. Ki malachav yisavelach l'shomrecha v'chol derachecha al kafayim yisa'uncha al shachal fetin tidroch. For God will charge his angels for you to guard you in all your ways. On palms they will carry you, lest you strike your foot against the rock. Upon the lion and the viper you will tread. You will trample the young lion and the serpent. So, Rashi says it in a way that also is, you could, whatever, you take issue, however you'd like to say, challenge his notion of femininity, feminine understandings. He says that these are typical words of a mother's blessing. But it doesn't sound so typical to me of the feminine blessing, though obviously praying for safety of a child, but I don't think that fathers and mothers have any difference in praying for the safety of children. Up to this point, his mother blessed him, Berachto imo, Mikan ve'elach Berachto shamayim, from this point on, heaven blessed him, God blessed him. So you have this power of what? On the one hand, being someone whose Yetzer Hara doesn't take you over, in the context of the passage of Rav Chisda's teaching, and you're someone who forges a holy relationship between two married individuals, or it means, right, that it's someone who keeps with the teachings of his family and his people, and where parents bless a child, mother and father alike, in order to keep their children safe, so that the indwelling presence of God then comes and Shemayim blesses them, and God blesses them. So in a kind of microcosmic way, we have what will lead to the blessing of God versus what will lead to the feeling of exile and the abandonment by the Shekhinah of the individual. That's an essential teaching amidst the particulars about individuals who do not receive world to come. Okay. Let's move on to another section. Turn to 103b1. You know that sometimes I like to show you some features within the Talmudic literature that highlight some of what is going on currently in the rabbinic period of the Talmudic rabbis and the production of the Talmud, and what's being kind of discussed by way of their attachment to certain institutions, both inside, internal to the rabbis, and a little bit external. When I say a little bit external, I mean that there's a tradition of scribal reality of scrolls of the Tanakh, which exists already during the rabbinic era. And for sure, we understand a lot more today that the Masoretic text, right? We say that our Tanakh is based on Masoretic text. For sure, there are schools of Masoretes in various places throughout Jewish lands. And certain ways of writing verses are what are acceptable within certain scrolls. Until the Rambam's time, we don't have an absolute codification of the Masoretic way, because Masoretic representation of the oral tradition of performing these texts is being formed and shaped in various parts of the Jewish world throughout the rabbinic era. So in the Gemara, when we're talking about wicked people and becoming someone who understands what it means to have great character and be on the path of tshuva and potentially accept the world to come, you can learn from the way that verses are written. Because you have a scroll that's considered authoritative. Either the way something's written is reminding you of an inherited tradition which has been passed down, and there's some kind of symbolic way that the word indicates that you should know the accepted oral tradition that goes along with that word, or there were suggestions about what should be the proper Masoretic way of writing a scroll, which would later on become the proper way to write any codex. Because remember, Jews don't adopt the codex form until much later, post-Christian and Roman history, first centuries thereof. So that it could be a workout in the Gemara of some of the accepted and right traditions with the Masoretic text that is local to the sage, and they're attaching the Midrash to a unique feature of the written text here in our passage, which we're going to read. That is just all for introduction of what will become now a discussion of why a certain letter looks the way it does in text, in terms of how it's written. So go to the left-hand column on 103b1 now. Returning to its discussion of the wicked kings of Judah, the Gemara presents an exegesis of Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish concerning wicked people in general. Amar Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish. Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish says, "My dichtiv, what's written? Vayimana mirshaim oram uzroa rama tishaver. What is meant by that which is written? And from the wicked will be withheld their light. The high arm will be broken. Mipnei ma ayin shel rishaim teluya. Specifically, why is the letter ayin in the word rishaim suspended higher than the other letters in that word? Look down below at the note, number 3. In the Masoretic text, the letter ayin in the word rishaim is not written on the same line as the other letters of that word, but rather slightly higher. Rishaim. See the ayin there? How it's a little higher? The visual effect of this variation is that the word may be read as if the letter ayin were missing, with the resulting word being rashim, poor persons. Now we'll say more about authoritative Masoretic traditions at Shavuot time, because we're reading the great tale of the Aleppo Codex and the intrigue and the mystery, you know, the Syrian reality and where it lived then. But we'll talk about the history of it too on Shavuot night. Bekitzur, in short form though, the Masoretic text that we're referring to in this case, in the note, is the Masoretic text that's acceptable by way of the Aleppo Codex, which is, we say, the Ur Masoretic text, except that there were other Masoretic traditions, as I explained before we read this passage, and that is scrolls done by different Masoretes might have had the Ayin above, might have not had the Ayin above. Could be by this time, again, that it's all scrolls that have the Ayin above. Could be that we're working out what is the right and accepted way of integrating the Masoretic tradition into rabbinic acceptable scrolls, so that we may read from them and learn the tradition we need to. In this case, the Gemara asks, why is this Ayin sitting above the line? What do I learn from it? That Ayin being part of the word evildoers, or without the Ayin, because of the way it sits there, that word being Rashim, poor people. Kevan shenase adam rash milamata, it is to teach you that once a person becomes destitute of friends below, according to the idiomatic translation over here, in our translation, naase rash milamala, it's indicated that he's also become similarly destitute above, that means in heaven. If a person is hated by people below, Rashi kind of explains, he's subjected to two forms of poverty. One on heaven and one on earth. So that what we have is an individual who, through his being an evildoer, also becomes poor and destitute. The word itself represents such a read of the text. By allowing you to first read it as Rishaim and also as Rashim.
How about the allusion to light? Would this have any connection with the whole sentence? Is that they will be withheld from their light? And I don't understand what the high arm will be broken means either. So, does the raised ayin have any relationship to those two thoughts?
Well, I can't tell you from the text itself, Bobby, if I can answer textually. I mean, I can't tell you from the text. In this case, unless somebody sees it being really referred to in a certain way that is possible, I don't think the or here in this part of the Gemara is dealt with at all.
And what does it mean the high arm will be broken? What is that referred to?
Yeah, I don't have a textual tradition. How do you see that, Jay?
Well, as Bobby's saying, I assume that the ayin, the shape of the ayin, or the positioning of the ayin is the high arm. But I don't know if it was referring to arrogance on the part of that person and why he's losing his friends, or what the high arm refers to.
The high arm could be both ways. It could also be, you know, the mighty arm of God will not be helpful to him. As if it's broken. And that was the other way that I was trying to figure out the fit.
Haughtiness.
Yeah, I think it's double-sided, at least for us reading it in English.
I mean, this stands up as higher than the other, so maybe it's a visual.
You put another drush on it. I'm is not just the letter, it's also the word for Ayin. And it's a little drush. So if you look at that, Ayin shel Rashaim Tluya, V'Yimana Mirashaim or Ram. Or is light, and you see light through the eyes, so it's like your ability to see the light is gone. Mm-hmm. That's a little drush.
Mm-hmm.
Play on that. But I can tell you from working with ancient manuscript, medieval Hebrew manuscript,
mm-hmm.
that the common practice of, because it's all copied by hand, it's manuscript, if they missed a letter or they missed something, they put it on top of the line exactly with a little marker so you know that it was a typo or something.
Uh-huh.
And that's all it is. It's a typo.
Uh-huh.
So if you're talking about different texts, because I work with these documents, with these manuscripts, typos are done that way. The copyist realizes, hey, I made a typo. They put it either on top of the line or exactly on the margin. Very common.
So a social historian might really love that explanation for certain of
the
Masoretic marks.
Yes.
The idea, though, that the Masoretes had really a transmission idea in mind with all of their marks that other communities were not doing really is what differentiates the Masoretic tradition. And by the time that it becomes in codex form, with the Masoretes, and then the Aleppo Codex, and what we call today the Leningrad Codex, it is an unbelievable collection of indicators for commentaries and other kinds of either drashot or ways of reading that are either wrong or right, and it's a reminder of the type of performance of the text. So I'm not sure it wasn't that it, you know, was the first one a forgotten ayin? Well, one could, you know, theoretically try to prove from medieval manuscripts, but the interesting piece here, mind you, and we don't have all that many, is that we're talking about ancient scrolls. And I'm not sure how many exist of Job, Eov, where this is taken from. I'd have to do a little bit more work, but this seems to be this definitely predates the medieval manuscripts that we have, and copyists at that time for sure had different methodologies than writers of scrolls earlier on. The whole notion of having major copyists is even a little bit suspect, where there was smaller societies of Masoretes really guarding closely the kind of traditions we had at this point. I mean, let's put it this way. In the early part of the Middle Ages, whatever you want to call those dates, right, copyists and the whole notion of booksellers who engage copyists is a whole new industry versus an age before that where there's not really an industry for that per se. And not in as widespread away. The chapter from Job from which this is taken is, you know, one of the all-time most, you know, profound chapters of the book and of the Tanakh. Mize machshich etza Benilin Blidat, who is this who darkens counsel speaking without knowledge? Gird your loins like a man, I will ask, and you will inform me. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundations? Speak if you have understanding. Do you know who fixed its dimensions or who measured it with a line? You know, this is chapter where there's such challenge. And I suppose that you could say that, you know, the light that's being withheld, you know, is that kind of, yeah, whatever you want to call that. Hor shel tzadikim, the light of the righteous, the grace of God, the presence of the Shekhinah. And since Rashi really says, Sheesh lo sonim ve'ein ruach habriot nochaimenu, that people really come to hate a person who's acting in evil ways, and people themselves really don't feel any kind of endearment towards the person at all. You know, there's no kind of sense that this person really is deserving a space in my heart. You want the opposite. I think that it's striving for want, and it's desirous of us producing and making lives that we're rewarded with the opposite. But
what if the high arm is also the violent arm, not the aggressive arm? I mean, I don't know whether it's haughtiness or raising your hand.
Well, yeah. Yeah, it doesn't feel like the outstretched arm that's going to redeem, right? It could be the opposite of that, because there's a certain notion of playing out the whole notion of redemption all the way back from Shemot, all the way back from Exodus, which we talked about before. I think you brought up personally before. So anyway, these Masoretic notes lead to these traditions and these lessons. It's an interesting feature. And one that is worth noting. Keep going with me in the text now. We're going to turn to where the chapter is dealing with a few verses from Eicha, from Lamentations. And why would it? Because, again, the narrative of history, the chapters of history that come to demonstrate to us just what could happen, what is, you know, the potential consequence for this worldly sin versus righteous behavior is here at bay. And again, features of a life lived during the rabbinic era. They really want to include some of their realia when it comes to the material they include. And I think I left this bubble, I'm sorry, it's my little note here. Didn't mean to block out some of the Gemara's text for you. But we're talking about Eicha on 104b2. 104b2. All right, so I'm down on the bottom of the right-hand side, Kol Ovrei Derech, all who pass by the road. Amar Rav Amram Amar Rav. Rav Amram says in the name of Rav, Asauni Ka'ovrei Aldat, Jerusalem declared, they have made me like transgressors of the law. In other words, they have made me, right-hand side, bottom of the column. They've made me like transgressors of the law, meaning, according to Maharsha, they have made me like the people of Sodom, because we're just about to mention Sodom v'Amorah, and compare the people of Jerusalem to the destruction that went on and the consequences that the people of Sodom v'Amorah really felt. The Ilu b'Sodom k'tiv Hashem imtir al Sodom. For regarding the destruction of Sodom, it's written, and Hashem rained down upon Sodom sulfur and fire. The Ilu b'Yerushalayim k'tiv, and regarding Jerusalem, it's written, mimarom shalach esh ba'atzmotai v'yiradena. While regarding the destruction of Jerusalem, it's written, from on high He sent a fire into my bones and it crushed them. And you see here the continuation, thus Jerusalem declared, I was punished through fire just like Sodom. Now what's the difference between the punishment of Jerusalem and the punishment of Sodom? Sodom and Amorah, Sodom and Gomorrah, everybody completely was wiped out. And that was a destructive fire, Allah, kind of the hint of destruction that you felt back in Parshat Noach, back with Noah's story. Jerusalem, is it such a destruction? Not exactly. The Gemara will note it. So, Uchativ, Vayigdal Avon Bat Ami Mechatat Sodom. It's written, the iniquity of the daughter of my people was greater than the sin of Sodom. Pretty bad.
Well, there's another difference. I mean, Sodom was destroyed by God, and Jerusalem was destroyed by Roman armies. It seems Sodom's sins were greater.
Right, you could say on the face of it that we know that. So then why does the Gemara present this kind of even purposeful... Why is the Gemara pushing it? If we already know that God really did Sodom Gomorrah, and the Romans are just who are maybe the okay, so we're talking about both, like the Babylonians and the Romans at this point, right? In our destruction narrative, why is the Gemara pushing it to say we were as bad? One possibility is that it's trying to really say to you, trust me, this is God doing this. These people are the instruments of the Lord. That is a conception from prophetic literature, right? The Assyrian conquerors are the great force from the north. That's one possibility. The other possibility is to really say about you that you fit into this category of someone from Sodom and Gomorrah. Sodom v'Amorah. Be careful. What do you think of when you think of the sins and iniquities of those from that group? You think of sexual impropriety. You think of licentiousness. You think of all the things that we're going to read about. And by the way, if you don't think about them yet, if you're reading the Gemara for the first time, this is what's beautiful about including it here. One of the reasons why I'm including this passage here, though further detail about the Sodomites and the Amorites comes later, post the second Mishnah, is because this is another of those examples where the Gemara includes just a bit to foreshadow what will come later in the Perek. Because it can't introduce a subject like this and refer to this chapter in history and leave it completely, because it's going to be mentioned in the next Mishnah. It's going to be explicated further in the Gemara passage towards the end of the Perek. So next week, when we finish up with some material, part of the material will be about the people of Sodom v'Amorah. But here it's mentioned that we were as bad as they are, and ask the question, though. Now, if Jerusalem were more wicked than Sodom, should favoritism be shown in the matter? Why was Jerusalem not completely overturned, as was Sodom? So that's a good question.
Promise. I mean, Sodom and Amorah, that's permanence. I mean, this, throughout all this, I'm not sure I understand. The only reason I can come up with is trying to prove a point that we were even worse than them is just to show how important, how magnificent God's love is for the people of Israel, because throughout all this, there's a promise of this coming to an end.
Okay, so good. So let's take the possibilities. One is that there's going to be the promise that resides and rests in Yerushalayim, and we can't have the utter destruction of Ir HaKodesh. What's another thought before you read the Gemara?
Tons of righteous people in Jerusalem.
So what about the whole notion that we hear Avraham's argument with Sodom and Amorah kind of pulsing through our minds, through our hearts, whenever the story is mentioned, right? Especially as conversant readers. So too in the rabbinic age. I would say that the notion of Avraham's challenge to God about finding even this many righteous souls, even that many righteous souls, is for the rabbinic era part of the acceptable, part of the acceptable literacy that goes along with it. It's part of the accepted literacy or the inherited literacy that goes along with the story. So what's the Jewish conception? Let's go find the righteous souls. And for their sake, they will save the city. And now the compassionate God, who if God would have only found such compassionate souls might have saved Sodom and Gomorrah, definitely will save our city in some way. And that's what's going to happen here. Amar Rav, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Rav said the name of Rabbi Yochanan, Mida Yitzeder Haitav Yerushalayim Shalo Haitav Sodom. There was an extra measure in Jerusalem that was not present in Sodom. Jerusalem had something in its favor that Sodom did not have. The ilu vi Sodom kativ hine ze haya avon Sodom achotech gaon sivat lechem the yadani ve'evion lo hechezika. For regarding Sodom, it's written, see, this was the sin of Sodom, your sister. Pride, surfeit of bread, and undisturbed peace were hers and her daughters, but the hand of the poor and the needy they did not support. By the way, introducing a complete lesson about what the Gemara feels is the absolute evil of Sodom v'Amorah and how it relates to our being generous with our tzedakah. Keep that in mind, because we'll see text that explicates that point further in the pages that we'll look at next week to finish up our learning in this chapter. Ve'ilu b'Yerushalayim kativ, and about Jerusalem it's written, Yidei nashim rachamaniyot bishlu yaldehen. Whereas regarding Jerusalem it's written, the hands of the compassionate women boiled their children. So how is that learning in favor of Jerusalem? This is in the book of Eicha. When we sit and we read the text on the destruction of Jerusalem. But what is at the heart of that for the Gemara reader here, for the Midrashic teaching here? That the inhabitants of Sodom, blessed with the bread and blessed with abundance, kept food from the poor, impoverished, and the hungry. And only with the most utter despair and the craziness of the world being turned upside down were these absolute compassionate mothers forced into what? Letting their children starve. The verse does not mean the pshat, cooking their children. Now we understand the pshat of the verse. If you read that verse and you're disgusted and you're horrified, if that's what the verse's language should be. The verse is saying, like here in Sodom and Gomorrah, where they let people starve, but out of their evil willingness and desire to let them starve, compassionate mothers saw their children starve in that siege. That's what I think the one aspect of this passage is saying. It's very grisly.
Why doesn't it say, use the language that you've just used, instead of boiling their children?
Because that's quoting the verse from Lamentations.
Yes. Rashi seems to think it's literal. I mean, there's Shabbosim, he seems to translate it.
You are right, but I feel that that is not where we end up. That's not where we end up. They can't hardly imagine, believe, and consider the pashat of that verse, the simple sense of that verse. That's not the compassionate mother of
maybe
Israel.
What it means is sharing that which the children don't eat because the children don't, if you want.
But the scholars now know that in the prehistoric people, there was a tradition of eating children. They just don't know if they would eat their enemy's children or they eat their own children. They now have sufficient evidence to understand that it was a problem.
Well, I don't know about eating, right? They know about sacrificing.
No, they ate them. They sacrifice. They ate them because they look at bones, and if the bones are gnawed and the marrow is drawn out and they know they were buried, they weren't mauled by animals, well, then that's evidence that they were eaten. And that's how they...
In this part of the world?
Well, in the prehistoric people, so the prehistoric people that I was just studying are people who lived in Spain and France, but they came out of the Mideast because they went from Africa through the Mideast, right?
There's evidence as of late in Biblical Archaeology Review and certain of these articles in the Biblical Archaeologists Reviews that we have more evidence that certain temples, especially I think one was recently unearthed in Jordan, where they definitely sacrifice children.
Yeah, no, they're sacrificing, but this is eating.
We know from Molech that kids were passed through the fire.
Yeah, that's much like.
I want to say that because this is put over and against the Sodom, the teaching of Sodom and what they did in terms of letting people starve, and there are ways, the Gemara is going to explain how they actually accomplished that with their just absolute grotesque practices as a society, that we experienced the exact opposite, and that is, we starved in the siege. It makes me, I'll tell you, that it makes me think that the verse is put in for, you know, what is considered to be shock value.
An
echa,
you know, it goes to the absolute extreme.
Absolutely.
The dregs and the, so these things are referenced in order to make that effect and to make you feel as though this is the extreme, extreme low point of any existence.
That's right.
So, it, you know, it here too could be inserted for that dramatic effect, and doesn't necessarily mean it was practiced at that time, but just to imagine it is to bring you to the extreme.
Right. Meanwhile, we now have the sense that you don't scoff, you don't lie, you don't, you know, that packet of value orientations that we looked at. And we also have made now mention of keeping far from behavior that would make others feel as though you don't really earn a place in their heart. And we also now have this kind of ethical outlook on life where we have to consider our policies regarding those who are hungry and needy and the compassion we have for one another in our partnerships and towards our children. So these are the positive ways of saying everything we've seen so far within the tractate, that's not simply about the individuals and the verses that deal with the particularly named individuals who don't have a share in the world to come. I want to move us forward, again, to get to that next Mishnah in the Perek. Turn now with me to 106a2. Okay. So I want to talk here about the immorality that comes vis-a-vis both two very, very particular areas of sin and what we know is lascivious behavior. And that is, we're going to put it out there in the context of the story of Bilaam, who is what? Asked to curse the Jews by King Balak. And he wants the Jewish people to exist in a state of great immorality so that what? His curse can work even the more so. And here, you know, listen to the elements of the story and we can be again shocked or dismayed that it uses women's wiles to absolutely lead them into such behavior. And we are. We say these are, in that way, from a feminist read, difficult texts, that these should be the ways that Jews are tricked into immoral behavior. And we note the kind of outlook on the Moabite women, the harlots at least, from that people, who will lead the Jews to sin. And so we'll push into the story, though, and hear the elements. So, left-hand column, bottom. The Gemara details Bilaam's advice. Amar lahem, Bilaam says to the Moabites, Eloheihem shel elu sone zimahu. The God of these Jews hates immorality. Vehem mit avim lichle fishan. And furthermore, I know that they have a penchant for linen garments. Right, from the time that they were in Egypt. the Mefarshim add. They like these linen garments. Bo v'ashyachaitza. Let me tell you how you're going to get these people into a place where you're going to kibosh them. Aselahen kilayim. Set up tents for them. The hoshiv bahem zonot. And place harlots inside them. Zekeinah mibachutz v'yavda mibifnim. An elder outside and a younger inside. Yeah.
So let's hear what happens.
Klei fishtan, and have them sell the Jews' linen garments. Aselahen klaim ahar sheleg ad beit hayishimot. Taking Bilam's advice, Balak sets up tents for the Jews throughout the territory controlled by the Jews all along the Jordan, from Snow Mountain, Mount Carmel, in the north, to Beit HaYishimos in the south. V'hoshiv bahen zonot, and he places harlots inside. We're going to make this ruse. The zekeinami b'chutz, the elder outside, the yaldami bifnim, the younger one inside, uvishaash Yisrael ochlin v'shotin v'smechin v'yotzin l'tayel v'shuk, and when the Jews would eat, drink, and marry, and go out for a walk in the marketplace set up by the Moabites, omeret lo hazakena, the older harlot would say to the Jew, "I atan v'kesh klei fishtan, are you not interested in buying linen garments?" Zakena omeret lo b'shave, the older harlot would offer the linen garment at its full price. The Yalada Omeret Lo Bifachot, and the younger one inside would call to him from the inside and say, "Here, take it for less," persuading the Jew to purchase it from the inside of the tent. Shtayim v'shalosh panim, pleased with his bargain purchase, the Jew would begin to frequent the store two or three times, in other words, come back. V'achar kach Omeret Lo, afterwards, after they become friendly, the younger would say, "Hare at kaven bait, look, you're like
family discount.
Yeah, you're like mishpacha. Shev baror latznicha. Sit down, choose for yourself from the merchandise at leisure. V'tzartzurei shel yayin amunei munachetzla. Pitchers of Ammonite wine were placed near her. V'adayin lo nesar yayin shel amunei v'lo yayin shel nochrim. And at that time, the wine of the Ammonites and the wine of Gentiles hadn't been prohibited yet. Halachic development mentioned in the Gemara, by the way.
Right.
Amra lo, she would say to him, "Ritzon cha shetishte koshel yayin? Would you care to drink a cup of wine?" Kei ban sheshata bar bo. Once he drank and became intoxicated, rage within him. Amar la, hashmili, he would say to her, "Yield yourself to me." At that point, she would bring forth her idol from her bosom. Amra lo avod laze, would say to him, "Worship this, and I'll yield myself to you." Amar la, he would say to her, "Halo Yehudi ani, but am I not a Jew?" Amra lo ma yichvad lecha, she'd say to him, "What do you care? Klum mevakshim imcha ela pior. We're asking you to defecate before the idol. What's so wrong with that?" Who eno yodeya shavurata b'chach, right? Bracketed remark that an editor feels is necessary to insert. He doesn't know that that's the way to worship such an idol. V'lo od, and not only that, she would continue. Ela she'eni minachtecha ad shetichpor b'torah Moshe rabcha. I won't permit you to cohabit with me. In other words, I won't lie with you until you repudiate the Torah of Moses, your teacher. And in fact, he would. Hema ba'u val pa'or. As it's stated, they came to Baal Pa'or. The yinazru la boshet v'hiyu shekutzim ke'ohovam. And they strayed into shame in their lust. They became detestable. Whoa. That's a story.
That's a good story.
You
the idols, you know, yeah. The idols we have are like this big. So they really, she really could take it out of her bosom, and she would hold it dear because an idol is not just precious because it's religious, but it's made out of precious materials.
Right? Doesn't it speak to those, I mean, you go and look at the objects,
and
you really can see that this was something that might happen.
Absolutely, that's what I'm saying. I was just, if anyone hadn't seen our little, we have a few of them.
And the notion of bodily function and the worship thereof, people think you offer food?
I think that part's made up by the Jews.
I don't know.
We don't have any cuneiform text that tells us
plot. That. I mean, it revolves, coming back several times. I mean, it's a real entrapment kind of thing.
Well, it's a real entrapment. It's a real sting. But the idea is what? The idea is what? You can be so weak. You can be so weak as to give in to this type of ruse, this type of entrapment. Do not be weak.
Obviously people did it.
I mean
the literal steps, but I meant the inducement that they...
Yeah, obviously there was some inducement in the world, but the notion of being subjected to such seduction on behalf of those who worship other gods to move you into a different realm, based in what? In idolatry and sexual and or bodily acts that were associated with the worship of other gods during this time, was a prevalent thought beyond the Talmudic framework. It for sure existed, and it was discussed in the houses of philosophy, and in particular in literature that was produced by someone known to the rabbis, whose thought and philosophy could have been shared, Judaic thought and philosophy, and that is Philo. And so what I want to do is I want to read you from Philo of Alexandria, who, in his education, you know, Philo is that person who exists between Jerusalem and Athens, in a real way. And, you know, according to scholars, and this is one of the wonderful books about that age in terms of the Jews and the Mediterranean diaspora, this one is from Alexander to Trajan by John Barclay. He is tracing the education that Philo had as being of the age of Hellenism and in its greatest kind of sense of free and progressive society, allowed for this Jew to become a full citizen, to have been educated in all the great Hellenistic Greek philosophy and literature and mathematics. You know, he, along with Aristobulus, really loves Pythagoras and his theory and his numeracy. The whole notion of numbers and the language of numbers, he writes some numeric commentary on the Bible itself as well. And he creates philosophy and Jewish thought and commentary on the Greek Bible he has. He's most likely working with that as his base. Living in Alexandria, Egypt, for him, is this particular spot where he's, though, seriously able to remain loyal to an unfolding rabbinic Jewish way of practice. Now, it's very much in its early stages. Or you could say maybe it was 100, 200 years old already. Depending on how you look at the Alexandrian community and what we really understand about that world, which is yet to entirely be unlocked. But here he was, really proud of the Jews' place in history. He definitely stood for the sense that the Jewish people's place in history was unique, and that Torah and a life of mitzvot, life of an approach defined by the rabbis, by Torah, was unique and distinct. And he writes in what's called Decal the following. The Jews' distinction in piety is matched by their preeminence in virtue. So then the scholar here explains, given Philo's social context, it's hardly surprising that Egyptians are vilified as irreligious and irrational hedonists. It's more striking that key elements of Hellenistic culture become targets of criticism. Much as he enjoys the games, Philo scorns the exaggerated significance given to athletics. He ridicules their concern with physical prowess and deplores the violence in boxing and pancratist contests. He charges the theaters with sensuality and the clubs with degeneracy. Sharp contrasts are drawn between the ordered and pious festivals of Jews and the licentious, idolatrous extravagance of Greek festivals. As a foil to the banquet of the Thripitae, Philo lambasts the morals of Greek dinner parties and launches a savage attack on the Symposium of Plato. In particular, of course, he reacts with horror to all the positive images of sexuality, including homosexuality, and on this and other aspects of sexual morality, he claims for Judaism the moral high ground in restraint of pleasure and adherence to the laws of nature. Philo is aware that in these and other matters, the peculiarity of Jewish customs brings unpopularity and a reputation for antisocial behavior. Like an orphan among the nations, he writes, the Jewish people have no friends. Their exceptional laws demand the highest virtue, an austere standard, which is anathema to the pleasure-loving mass of men. The latter, one imagines, would hardly appreciate his slightly priggish tone.
Story is very much alive today.
I was in Mykonos last summer.
The story that we read here about the seduction of the Jew so that the Jew becomes less moral, to eat away at Jewish morality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this morning in the New York Times we read about Israeli reports of Hezbollah putting all of their armaments in civilian communities. And I think that actually is exactly the same intention. It's to trap the Jew into doing something that they will view as, transgressing their moral responsibility, and therefore leaving them open to the claim that, in fact, they have no higher moral standing than anyone else. And I think it's really, this mentality is really the central driving force of anti-Semitism, is that driving constant to knock the Jew down and to show that they, in fact, are not committed to any higher standard.
And in addition, this story, I think, can be seen not that the Jew falls so easily, but that they have to make this very elaborate sham and intoxicate and entrap and seduce in order to bring that. And it gives them great pleasure to do that, that they're ready to do this very elaborate thing.
Right. It's worth it to invest this much energy in the process.
Pretty, nefarious thing to say the older ones outside and the younger ones inside. I mean, it's a real ruse. It's a really constructed thing to break down whatever the Jews, barriers are.
It just came to me. I would just suggest that it was also flip it. And they're basically saying this is how the world sees the Jews. And it's the Jews who are the entrappers. Because it's the Jews who really did run economic capitalism, and so they had the shooks, they had the money lending, they were the ones who seduced you by you accepting a loan, and then they would make the terms difficult so that they could get the land back instead of just taking back whatever value you might have had in goods or cash. Has anyone ever read it that way?
Say it again.
In this period?
Say it again.
I'm asking you.
So, can you say that again?
That in essence, I'm struck with how much we feel that it's such a highly developed contrivance. So I'm reading it from the other way, that they are making fun of what the world makes fun of the Jew, that the Jew entraps the Gentile through the Jew's economic capitalism, that the Jews are the people who lend the money, the Jews are the ones who do the contracts, the Jews are the ones who sit at the city gate and do the deals, and if you can't fulfill your deal, I'm very happy to take over your land. If you gave your land as security, and you can't return the six cows to the flesh.
I don't think at this period in history we can say that that's operative here. Yeah, I think that...
That's what I'm asking.
Yeah,
I think
we really at a certain point...
They certainly are the merchant class given in Baba Kama and all those other...
Not in that way that you're... I think that, you know, what's the book that we... I think we both read that the review of the book, and then you were...
You were talking about the Israeli one about money in the ancient eras.
I'm thinking about the book that was in the New York Review of Books that talked about, instead of anti-Semitism, it was anti-Judaism.
David Newberg. Right.
So
anti-Judaism.
So in looking at that, I think he would also agree that it's a much kind of later.
Okay.
Much later, you know, reality, mm-hmm. and that this kind of inherent anti-Judaism, anti-mercantilism, not when we were being colonized. Not when the Jews were in the situation of experiencing this kind of minority status in a very deep way.
It was about the separatism. There was a lot of resentments about the being separate, not going along with things,
right.
Which is not from a point of power, it's from a point of, you know, anger, and that they are not.
Not part of the rejection. There was a lot of resentment about this being separate, and you know, who do they think they are, and that comes through with the philo that he read. There is a new book by Michael Hudson about that, whose title is Labor in the Ancient World, which is a much broader and deeper understanding of the role of credit, and I'm going to use credit as we all understand it from capitalism today, going back to even for this time. So the book was just published in England. I haven't read it yet. I've read his other works.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something I'm studying right now, so I'm conscious of it. But I think it's a more developed capital system, at least in terms of credit, than you know, we generally have been thinking about.
I think if anything...
It's not a historical... it's sort of been a fantasy that would happen in the Philum and the Bullock.
Right.
This story with the old harlot, the new harlot, they're just trying to come up with some kind of an excuse for these people. But the truth of the matter is that they sinned. They sinned evilly. They had just seen the theophany, they had just accepted the Torah, and within a couple of weeks they were in the trenches.
That's right.
So this is...
And the Torah's project, and part of the rabbinic project, is to say,
right.
It's so easy. Be strong, as I think, you know, I started with that because it's the message that you're going to fall into this. And by the way, remember, in a certain sense, yes, it's true that monotheistic faith is playing out at this time and its roots are here, but there's still idolatrous practice around. And the rabbis pick up on the Torah's real sense of stay far from that idolatrous behavior. And so it highlights that piece, which other literature at the time, again, we have to learn from outside literature, whether we're talking about the biblical age, which won the Jewish Book Prize this year, the three volumes of outside biblical literature, and this set of texts that are around in the rabbinic age that people, by the way, you know, you didn't save them from a fire again, but we'll just remind ourselves, you could have some texts around in Greek, and they weren't all of the canon either. So you might have had a copy of the Wisdom of Solomon. Wisdom of Solomon's definitely going around in the rabbinic period. We don't exactly know who the author is of this one. Rails against idolatry in its own right. So listen to this piece. When he turns to the second category, idolatry, because there are three sections dealing with three types of error. Error of Jewish ways, particularly. And we know this from the Book of Kings, right? We've seen that these evil kings were idolaters and turned to idols. There's not a moment's hesitation in the powerful flow of rhetoric. Miserable, with their hopes set on dead things, are those who call gods the work of human hands. The author thinks he knows the origin of such folly. In the sorrow of a grieving parent who makes an image of the child he lost, or the concern of subjects to flatter their monarch by constructing a beautiful statue. Yet this neither excuses the idolatry nor diminishes its damaging effect. The author is confident that the invention of idols is the root of immorality, a claim which he expands in a list of moral and social corruption, especially in the sphere of sex. The diagnosis is simple enough. The worship of unmentionable idols is the beginning, the cause, and the end of every evil. Chapter 14, verse 27. He thus feels justified in launching a withering attack on all engaged in the manufacture of objects of worship, whether they work in wood or clay. In an outburst of invective of which Deutero-Isaiah would have been proud, he lavishes scorn on the fools who imagine that the wood they carve can respond to prayer, or the clay they fashion can save in its lifeless form. The rhetoric depends, of course, on a crude caricature of non-Jewish religion, but the author is confident that the impious man and his impiety are equally hateful to God. So I think the story generally builds on such a theme. And the rabbinic text we're dealing with wants to suppress, kibosh, overcome any inklings, inclinations towards that which is considered immoral and absolutely immoral in the general society of those who would still be attached to Torah-itic ways and definitely burgeoning and flourishing rabbinic ways. And so this story is rightfully shocking in that sense, and puts out all the things in one. Don't have idols. Don't drink wine. We've talked about this one. We learned Ben Sorer Amore, the rebellious son. Don't drink for such, you know, rowdy purposes, even if it's good Italian wine, remember? And no sex in the name of God. Worshipping God, that is. In the idolatrous way. So that really is the power of the good life. You're right. You might like nice clothes.
Now you know why they wanted them to be available when they came home from the trip.
Exactly. All right. Have a good night. Good to learn with you.
He doesn't get it, why the harlot outside is old and the harlot inside is young. You explain. Well, that's what Ron said in the beginning.
I think it's more trusting.
Trusting. Trusting. Trusting. Trusting. Oh. And then after they become comfortable, she's the little one, the younger one, put out the deal.
How old is the old harlot back then? I mean, she's an old lady, right?
Yeah, but she's probably well used.
She's more experienced.
Well, then you might
okay. So we're not going to be here next week, so it was a wonderful year. Thanks.
Oh,
so
well,
much.
As always, such a blessing to learn together.
Chicago and L.A.
All right, next week I'll also announce 4 dates during the summer that I'm doing the Talmud, one line at a time, the power of a punch. Talmudic quips, some statements of wisdom, and Talmudic insults.